Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled, Who Wants to Split a Plane with Me? By Andrew Zucker. Then Schaefer Lieber wrote, Dry Weddings Risk Inciting Guest Wrath. Brianna Abbott has, Younger People Spot Colon Cancer Earlier. Then Nadidi Subbarayan wrote, Fake Papers Flood Scientific Journals. And we'll follow that up with an article by Russ Schulkitz, AI doesn't care if you're applied to it, you should be anyway. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. Let's begin with today's first one, Who Wants to Split a Plane with Me? Nick Molina was in the American Express Centurion Lounge at New York LaGuardia Airport, chatting with a stranger about flight delays, when his fellow traveler asked if he'd ever considered flying private. She was telling me about this WhatsApp group, said Molina, a 57-year-old investor and former startup entrepreneur in Key Biscayne, Florida. She offered to get me added, which is how we ended up in S, Florida to New York, Northeast, one of several active group chats where travelers from the merely wealthy to actual billionaires buy and sell seats on private flights. These invite-only chats focus on gilded routes, New York to Palm Beach, Aspen to Southern California, Texas to Cabo, and include thousands of members at a time when delays and safety concerns have plagued commercial aviation. They'll go in a chat and say, hey, I'm going to Aspen on August 1st, who wants to split a plane with me, said Paul Peter Meninkis, who runs private jet charter company Priority One Jets. Real estate investor Enrico Scarda, 56, sold his own jet around a year ago, but hasn't sworn off his habit of flying private. He's a member of the same 676-person group as Molina, which operates like a Craigslist for 1% flyers moving up and down the East Coast. Through the group, he has flown on mid-sized jets, including a Dassault Falcon 50 and a Hawker 800. I guess at first I was a little hesitant about having a stranger meet you on a plane, Scarta said. But after the three or four times that I either bought a seat or sold a seat, I realized it's all pretty much the same types of people. Members of these clubs have seats on their own jets to defray costs or charter planes and look for splitters. Some are simply passengers with an aversion to TSA lines. Private jet brokers also pop in, offering their clients inventory. That often means seats on dead leg flights, empty jets trying to pick up passengers. Caden Green, a 20-year-old private jet broker, is active on many of these WhatsApp groups. He has found them to be valuable tools for generating client leads. It's free marketing, he said. It's not like you need to pay for an ad or anything. For some flyers, sharing cream-colored cabins with strangers defeats the purpose of flying private, stripping people of the ability to take to the skies whenever they wish. At the end of the day, you're still scheduling your day and your travel around the pre-booked flight plan, Molina said. Green, who estimates as much as 30% of his business stems from WhatsApp groups, recently started his own chat dedicated to private flights between Europe and the United States. Eric Kislin, an investor, started a separate 23-person Turks private jet group for travelers to Turks and Caicos, the British archipelago where he owns a home. What fuels these groups is a blend of penny-pinching ways and a thirst for luxury. I do understand that sometimes you don't want to spend $25,000 to $30,000 going up to New York, but you're okay spending $3,000 or $4,000, Kislin said. Scarter said most beach between New York and South Florida go for at least $2,000 in the WhatsApp group. Commercial airliners such as JetBlue and Delta ferry passengers on that route for as little as 1/10 of that sum. Before the pandemic, many flyers between these ritzy locales offered seats free to those in their network, according to Minkus, the charter broker. But as the private aviation market has expanded and a WhatsApp shadow economy has emerged, charging for seats has become more customary. The tight space, he said. Why do you want to be uncomfortable if you're not going to be compensated for it? Whether these trips comply with Federal Aviation Administration regulations is murky. Plane operators typically must be certified as Part 135 if they receive any money over their pro rata share of costs, according to aviation attorney Steve Tabor. Part 135 is a section of the FAA regulations setting rules and safety standards for on-demand, non-scheduled operators. If aircraft operators are found in violation, they can face actions including monetary civil penalties, according to aviation attorney Mary Caitlin Ray. Tabor added that FAA officials have pursued Instagram accounts and Facebook groups where users sell private jet seats for profit. For that reason, it might not be worth avoiding full-body scans and baggage fees. And there are other inconveniences that even the rich cannot escape. Kislin said shared private flights often end up delayed because the majority of co-travelers prefer to take off later. Well, that doesn't work for me, he said. That changes my schedule. But even if Kislin books travel elsewhere, remaining a part of these private aviation groups is valuable. For some jet setters, it is a standardy as being a member of Zero Bond. The conversation starter, because that's how many people in the network of Aspen are in that chat, Green said. And now, dry weddings risk inciting guest wrath. Gracie Gambrone is finalizing details for her October wedding. One thing she's known from the start, the party will not have any booze. If it's a day about us, it makes no sense to get alcohol, she said. And she's a 35-year-old marketing professional in Tampa, Florida. Her fiance, a Marine veteran, does not drink, and she does on rare occasions. So Gambrone plans to splurge on other costs, like hiring chefs to live cook paella and an artisanal coffee bar. She said one friend joked about bringing a flask, which took her aback. You can't enjoy 4 hours without alcohol. That's a deeper issue that I cannot fix, she said. My family is from the Dominican Republic. We'll be dancing regardless. An open bar was once the sign of a great party. But in the age of loud and proud sobriety, alcohol is no longer a must-have for couples on their wedding day. Some are asking guests to sip on mocktails, coffee, and soda, and dance their hearts out stone cold sober. This, surprisingly, has rankled people traveling from near and far to celebrate. Giovanni McCaffrey, an influencer in Atlanta, described a dry wedding she went to in Paris 2 years ago as the worst wedding I've ever been to. Your wedding is not only about you, McCaffrey, 29, said. It's also about making a good experience for the guests. Most weddings are still boozy affairs. Only 6% of couples who responded to the annual survey of wedding planners website Zola said they'd be hosting a completely alcohol-free wedding in 2025. But wedding vendors say more couples are cutting back. There have never been this many sober guests here, said Lisa Carvelis, co-owner of Cedar Lakes Estate, a venue in upstate New York, where the number of couples paying for the addition of a zero proof bar rose 56% this year. Carvelis said most weddings at Cedar Lakes Estate still have alcohol, but people are drinking less. It's quite nice. Use the word. Will they drunk swim in the lake? Carballo said. I don't worry about that as much anymore. Liz Taylor, a luxury events planner in the UK, said she's seen a rise in semi-dry weddings on her side of the town. They have to get up early to play paddle, to hit the gym, so they want one glass of champagne, and then they move on to something non-alcoholic, Taylor said. For some, a dry wedding is still considered taboo. The number one fear is how they will be perceived by their guests, said Lauren Ladoker, a wedding content creator who shoots iPhone footage for social media. Ladoker said she generally advises couples against cutting alcohol unless it's for religious reasons or a substance abuse history. In weddings, there are societal norms and expectations for the host, and I do think that an open bar is a part of that, she said. Caroline Wimberly, who works in tech and lives in California, is so opposed to dry weddings that she's gotten into fights on TikTok about it. I think it's tacky and bad hosting, Wimberly 31 said. She recalled a recent April wedding she attended in Palm Springs, where an open bar helped a lively dance crowd until midnight. Comes down to what a party is, she said. You eat, you drink, you gather. But Shelby Lyons, a 20-year-old product software specialist in Vancouver, Washington, said she specifically chose to have a dry wedding last month to avoid drunk family members. She said some family complained when they saw the disclaimer on her invitation. But Lyons said her dance floor was lively and no one left early, her biggest fear. She said guests love an Italian soda bar set up inside their barn reception. In the interest of keeping his budget low, Nathaniel Lieberman, a couch business co-owner in Chester County, Pennsylvania, got married back last September in a fire hall that took $700 to book. It did not allow alcohol on the premises. Instead, he hired a coffee cart. He said he's not a big drinker, and neither is his wife or their friends. I grew up knowing that if I went hog wild drunk, it would be recorded and live on the internet forever, Lieberman 27 said. At the dinner reception for Joanna Flynn's May destination wedding in Iceland, guests sipped mocktails inspired by Brandon Sanderson, the couple's favorite sci-fi author, including a violet wine made with grape soda and blackberry syrup. For us, it was an easy decision because we don't drink that much in our normal lives, said Flynn, 24, a copywriter in Manchester, New Hampshire. The couple and their families covered lodging and meals for all of their guests, so no one was too upset. Vicky Tejada, a human resources coordinator in Orlando, is planning to throw a dry wedding at a garden venue in October. Tejada said she does not want alcohol around the children and was also worried about drunk driving near the venue's remote winding roads. I understand you want your drinky drinks, but get to know your nieces and nephews and just hang out, Tejada 35 said. And then you'll remember, oh, Uncle Johnny, he was really cool. And now younger people spot colon cancer earlier. People under age 50 have been appearing increasingly at doctor's offices in the past few decades, complaining of blood in their stool, abdominal trouble, or unexplained weight loss. The diagnosis, colorectal cancer. And by that time, it was often too late. But the paradigm is finally starting to shift, at least for patients in their 40s. There has been a jump in people ages 45 to 49 getting screened for colorectal cancer after recent medical guidelines lowered the screening age for those at average risk. As a result, the disease is being caught sooner when it is more curable and the treatment is less grueling, according to new research from the American Cancer Society. The recent screening recommendations designed to catch cases sooner appear to be working. It's thrilling to see this, said Rebecca Siegel, an epidemiologist at the ACS and an author of the new research. It means fewer deaths and higher quality of life for people who are diagnosed. The findings came in a flurry of research published recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Colorectal cancer screening in the United States for adults ages 45 to 49 increased by 62% from 2019 to 2023, according to one ACS paper. Early stage diagnosis then surged, including a 50% relative increase from 2021 to 2022, according to another ACS report. A trial of more than 20,000 people in the same age bracket was published by a separate group of researchers showing that testing uptake increases when people are mailed stool tests by default versus when they are asked if they want a test or a colonoscopy. Screening rates in the trial were low, however, with 19% of people in the trial overall opting to get screened. We probably shouldn't be wasting time asking patients first. We should send them what they need, said Dr. Folicide May, the trial's senior author and a gastroenterologist at the University of California, Los Angeles. Colorectal cancer rates have been rising for people under 50 since the 1990s, and the disease is now the leading cause of cancer death among men in that group. Researchers are investigating everything from diet and lifestyle to environmental contaminants to find out why colorectal and other cancers are rising in younger adults. The ACS in 2018 started recommending that people with average risk as young as 45 get screened for colorectal cancer, down from the previous start at age 50. The United States Preventive Services Task Force filed in 2021. Its guidelines carry particular weight among primary care providers and often lead to health insurance coverage. Suddenly, millions of people were newly overdue for screening. For people in that 45 to 49 age bracket, cases jumped, going from about a 1% increase in the incident rate each year since 2004 to a 12% annual rise from 2019 to 2022, the data showed. The rise was driven by diagnosis of early stage disease. The post-COVID rebound in people seeking healthcare could contribute to some of the increase researchers said, but the change in screening guidelines is likely the biggest factor. The trend looks similar to what happened among people ages 50 and above in the late 1990s after screening was first recommended for them, said Caitlin Murphy, a cancer epidemiologist and professor of pediatrics at the University of Chicago, who was not involved in the studies. We'll still take time to see what the impact on deaths looks like for the newly eligible, she says. Ultimately, the goal of screening is to reduce mortality, and we haven't seen that quite yet, simply because not enough time has gone by. Up-to-date screening via colonoscopy for those aged 45 to 49 rose from around 20% of people in 2019 to about 28% in 2023, according to one of the ACS reports. The colonoscopy is the gold standard test that also helps doctors remove polyps to actually prevent the cancer from forming. Alternatively, use of tests that look for blood or DNA changes in the stool also increased, rising from 1.3% to 7.1% in that age group. Screening rates remain mostly stable in all other age groups, the report found. Screening rates also remained unchanged for people ages 45 to 49 with less than a high school education or those who are uninsured, and they still trail behind those for older adults who remain at higher risk. Factors including genetics, excess body weight, smoking cigarettes, and a diet heavy in red and processed meats also increase a person's chances of developing the disease. People in the 45 to 49 age bracket account for nearly half all colorectal cancers under age 50, ACS said. But that still leaves a lot of people who are at risk and are too young to be screened. I have patients in their 20s in my practice that would never fit the guidelines, said Dr. Michael Cicchini, a medical oncologist and colorectal cancer specialist at Yale Cancer Center. We need to be thinking about it on our list of possible diagnoses. And now, interesting article that was on the same page as the one just read. Fake papers flood scientific journals. A growing tide of fake papers is flooding the scientific record and proliferating faster than current checks can rid them from the system, scientists warn. The source of the trouble is paper mills, businesses or individuals that charge fees to publish fake studies in legitimate journals under the names of desperate scientists whose careers depend on their publishing record. The rate of fake papers generated by these operators roughly doubled every 1.5 years between 2016 and 2020, according to a study just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The entire structure of science could collapse if this is left unaddressed, said study author Luis Amaral, a Northwestern University physicist. Paper mills look for weak links, such as lax verification protocols in the typically rigorous publication machinery, then exploit those to place hundreds of fabricated studies with vulnerable journals or publishers, according to scientist investigators. It can be a costly mess to clean up. Publishers who have become aware of suspected paper mill activity have been forced to retract hundreds of papers at once, and in some cases, shut down journals. After retracting more than 11,300 papers that appeared compromised, Wiley, a United States-based publisher with a portfolio of 1,600 journals, last year said it would shut 19 of its publications, including some that had shown signs of takeover by paper mills. More recently, Taylor & Francis, an academic publisher of over 2,700 journals, said it would stop taking submissions to its journal Bioengineered while its editors investigated past papers for paper mill activity. But tracking the scale of these organized operations has been difficult. When paper mills are detected, they change their tactics, and few publishers disclose when they have been targeted. We only know about Wiley because they have been transparent about the way that they were trying to handle these issues, said Reese Richardson, a data scientist who studies publishing at Northwestern and who is an author on the PMAS study. The authors of the study created a database of suspected paper mill papers, over 32,700 in all, from nearly every publisher, by assembling the work of other volunteer investigators who have been cataloging groups of studies with similar patterns. With a big data approach that spans the published scientific record, the new study confirmed trends that scientist investigators of shoddy papers have shown for years. Artificial intelligence makes the trend especially concerning, said James Evans, a sociologist at the University of Chicago, who was not involved with the study. Because large language models are consuming scientific literature without discriminating between legitimate and fraudulent papers, paper mills can muddy the waters of science and scientific understanding, Evans did say. And now AI, artificial intelligence, does not care if you're applied to it. You should be anyway. I often catch myself prefacing my query to ChatGPT with a please and concluding with a thank you. Apparently, I am not alone. A study done in December 2024, published by TechRadar, found that approximately 67% of United States AI users are also polite and show gratitude towards AI search engines. On April 15th, an ex-user asked whether there's a cost to all this politeness. I wonder how much money OpenAI has lost in electricity costs from people saying please and thank you to their models. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman saw the post and responded, tens of millions of dollars well spent, you never know. Altman's comments suggest, perhaps half seriously, that polite behavior could be our salvation when AI systems take over the world in an apocalyptic future. In reality, of course, AI chatbots do not appreciate politeness. They lack consciousness, feelings, or a need for social niceties. AIs are designed to make us feel like we are interacting with a sentient being, but it's just that, a feeling. From a purely utilitarian standpoint, all these pleases and thank yous are just flushing money down the toilet. Still, there may be value that is not immediately measurable in showing gratitude towards AI. In their book, The Psychology of Gratitude, psychologists Robert Emmons and Michael McCullough write about a 10-week experiment they carried out called Counting Blessings versus Burdens. They divided participants into three groups, asking the first to list things they are grateful, the second to list daily irritations, and the third to just keep a journal. They found that the first group reported 25% higher happiness levels, showing stronger emotional resilience and were physically healthier. Other studies have also linked gratitude to better sleep, less depression and anxiety, and greater relationship satisfaction. Gratitude is not only a display of emotion, it actually has an impact on your biochemistry. What's true of gratitude is also true of kindness and generosity more generally. Sonia Ubarinsky, professor of psychology at UC Riverside and author of the book, The How of Happiness, conducted experiments where participants were asked to perform 5 small acts of kindness per week. She found that these small, frequent acts led to consistent and significant increases in happiness. These modern researchers are rediscovering an idea that was central to ancient and medieval philosophy, that we should train ourselves by performing good deeds regularly, not just for the sake of the people we benefit, but for our own. The medieval Jewish thinker Maimonides wrote that it is better for a person to give one dinar to 1,000 poor people than to give $1,000 to one poor person. If all that mattered was the total amount of money that went to the needy, there would be no difference between the two ways of giving. But Maimonides believed that regular acts of goodness, like giving charity and expressing gratitude, made us happier in the long run by turning virtue into a habit. So perhaps all of our pleases and thank yous to AI have value, even if they cost OpenAI millions of dollars annually. Showing appreciation, even towards a machine, reinforces positive habits of courtesy, patience, and empathy. In our increasingly digital and automated world, preserving these human qualities may be more valuable than the cost of a few extra kilowatt hours. Ultimately, the beneficiary of our politeness is not the AI at all, but ourselves. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I'll be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.